KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn.
In a very historic milestone this week, the NATO allies committed to dramatically increase their defence spending to that 5% of GDP, something that no one really thought possible. And they said, you did it, sir, you did it. Well, I don't know if I did it, but I think I did.
On Wednesday, the NATO summit in The Hague wrapped up with a commitment from allies to raise defence spending to 5% of GDP. We'll be spending the next half hour bringing you analysis and reactions from the Netherlands, Turkey, France, Spain and Germany, as well as answering some of your listener questions in the company of security correspondent Terry Schultz. That's here on Inside Europe.
Allies have laid the foundations for a stronger, fairer and more lethal NATO. NATO leaders agreed on the De Hague Defence Investment Plan. And this will fuel a quantum leap in our collective defence. They agreed to boost our defence industries, which will not only increase our security, but will also create jobs. And we have reaffirmed our unwavering support for Ukraine. All of this is crucial. This alliance is and will remain ready, willing and able to defend every inch of Allied territory.
NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte there, wrapping up the 2025 NATO summit in The Hague on a note of victory. The transatlantic military alliance is back on track. Anyone wanting to attack a European NATO member must now once again reckon with incurring the wrath of US military might. And the allies have committed to increase defence spending to 5% of GDP, although the wording did carefully say allies and not all allies, and exactly what counts as defence spending is to a certain extent up for interpretation. Still, all in all, a very successful summit from a NATO perspective, and that was by no means a given. The build-up to the summit was one of intense geopolitical tension, coinciding as it did with President Trump's decision to launch military strikes on nuclear sites in Iran and uncertainty as to whether a US-brokered ceasefire between Iran and Israel would hold. To set the scene for you, we tasked four of our correspondents with sending in the view from their country.
I'm Dorian Jones in Turkey, where President Recep Tayyip Erdogan welcomed the brokering of a ceasefire between Iran and Israel by his US counterpart Donald Trump. The conflict had stoked fears in Ankara of a refugee exodus from its Iranian neighbour that would add to the more than 4 million refugees already in Turkey. Erdogan, who routinely condemned Israel for its attacks on Iran, avoided any criticism of Trump for his launching of air assaults on Iranian targets. Ankara also resisted opposition calls for the closure of a vital US-operated radar base near the Iranian border. For Erdogan, maintaining close ties with Trump remains his diplomatic priority. With Iran, a regional rival, Ankara will likely also be hoping that the latest conflict ends any Iranian nuclear weapons ambitions, a goal Erdogan has warned would lead to a Middle East nuclear arms race.
I'm John Lawrence in France, whose reaction to the American strikes was muted. President Macron did not condone or condemn the bombings, but called for a de-escalation of the conflict and negotiations. He telephoned his Iranian counterpart to urge restraint to allow a return to diplomacy. Far-left members of parliament criticised him for not condemning the strikes as contrary to international law, with the leader of the France Unbowed party calling to cut ties with what he called the war makers. The far right, meanwhile, criticised the government for failing to explicitly support the US strikes, with one of the leaders of the Rassemblement National saluting the American action while saying it must be limited to bombing the nuclear facilities, not be the prelude to war. Meanwhile, a statement from the leaders of the E3, that's the UK, France and Germany, took a neutral line on the American airstrikes, but did say Iran must not have the bomb.
Bravo Alpha Tango Tango 2-1, Sevilla Control, radar contact, please confirm how many aircraft on formation?
The moment when three US stealth planes involved in the bombing in Iran communicated with civil air traffic control as they passed through Spanish airspace. Spain played no part in the attack, and the response from the government has been one of concern. The Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, reiterated that Iran must never have nuclear weapons, but emphasized as a matter of urgency that now was the time for de-escalation, dialogue and diplomacy. Spain's position in NATO has also angered Donald Trump after Pedro Sanchez refused to raise his country's defense budget up to the 5% GDP that Trump has demanded of all NATO allies. Sanchez argued that the new target would be incompatible with Spain's welfare state. In the build-up to the NATO meeting, the Spanish government issued a statement saying, "Of course we're a problem for Trump, because we are the only ones who say that the king has no clothes, even though many others think so, and we clearly oppose the absurd volume of spending he wants to impose on us." Ashish Sharma, DW, Madrid.
Pushed back by police in bushes near The Hague's main highway, climate activists are happy the NATO summit is over. Showing his bloodied arm after jumping over a ditch, David is upset that NATO agreed to spend over $2.5 trillion annually on weapons and related infrastructure.
My children, your children, we're going to leave them nothing but hopelessness.
My mother is upset too. Celebrating her birthday, she thought Trump could drop by for cake. She lives in Noordwijk, a peaceful coastal resort between Amsterdam Schiphol Airport and The Hague. The president was to stay in a nearby hotel overlooking the North Sea. Several roads were blocked entirely. However, Trump ultimately chose to spend the night at the royal palace of the Dutch king and queen. The outgoing government agreed to spend more than 183 million euros of taxpayers' money on the NATO summit. That translates to about 1 million euros, or $1.2 million, per minute. About the same length as this story.
Stefan Bos, representing the Netherlands there, and providing us with the perfect segue into the NATO summit itself. Inside Europe's security correspondent Terry Schultz was, of course, in The Hague. She was covering it all for DW News. And when I finally got hold of an exhausted Terry late on Wednesday evening, the summit was literally being packed up around her. This, however, was not a conversation that Terry was about to duck, particularly because I'd come armed with some listener questions to add to my own. The fantastically named Richard Deutsch wrote in to ask how the conflict in the Middle East is likely to impact Ukraine. And this was a question which also seems to have been on the mind of a rather familiar voice.
Hi, Terry. It's Helen here. Hope you're well. Now that I'm retired, I'm getting in touch as a listener and not as the producer of Inside Europe. I'd really like to hear your thoughts on whether Trump's very decisive military action in the Middle East has implications for Washington's approach to the war in Ukraine and for NATO. Could we now see decisive American support for Ukraine? Thank you very much, Terry. Bye.
So, Terry, based on what we've just seen happen at the summit, where does Ukraine seem to stand at the moment?
So my take on this is different than some other people's take on it. I think Ukraine really got left out in the cold here, because I know, for example, from sources that the U.S. actually wanted Ukraine not to be mentioned at all in the final document, which is only five paragraphs long. So, I mean, maybe the good news is that it is mentioned twice, but it is not mentioned in the kind of substantive way that it was last year at the Washington summit, for example, when you talked about the irreversible path toward membership. This time, Ukraine is mentioned only in the sense that Ukraine's security is European security. And it's mentioned that assistance to Ukraine can now be included in countries' tallies for their 5%. Ukraine could well be disappointed that, for example, there was not a NATO-Ukraine meeting at the leaders' level. President Zelensky was not sharing a stage with Mark Rutte or, of course, President Trump in a big press conference at the end. And this was very much designed by the Dutch hosts to avoid any chance that there would be a blow up, to avoid this horrible scene in the Oval Office that we all remember, where Trump and Zelensky are basically fighting, and nobody wanted that to happen again. So they wanted to minimize the interaction between the two. We didn't know for sure that they would even have a meeting at all, even a short meeting, until this morning. And then they confirmed that they would, and they did. And President Trump said afterwards in the press conference that it was a great meeting and Zelensky couldn't have been nicer. But at the same time, Ukraine was not a centerpiece of this summit, even though frontline states, Nordic and Baltic states, would have liked it to play a much bigger role.
Right, and Baltic states is key there, because although this doesn't help Ukraine, which isn't a member, the main takeaway really from the summit is that NATO member states close to Russia can now assume once again that if they are attacked, the US will come to their aid.
It does make all of the other countries feel quite reassured, and people are pretty dang happy with that, I can tell you that.
Right, next question.
Hi, Terry and Kate. My name is Kat. I am calling in from Melbourne, Australia, to ask your European experts what the future of AUKUS is and whether the EU is concerned about Australia's security situation, given that America has seemingly pulled out of the deal, or at least admitted that it can't deliver the submarines that were part of the original deal. If you could go further into this, I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
I mean, this was something that was in the news in the last weeks, that the US is going to review its commitment to AUKUS, and that is a deal where these three countries share basically intelligence and nuclear know-how on submarines. But no, I mean, I have to be honest, I won't pretend to listeners that I looked into it deeply, because it wasn't brought up. And I think this was just one of those things that the Pete Hegseth Pentagon says it's going to look into. But no, it hasn't even, I mean, we haven't even talked about it at NATO.
Although presumably, Terry, the UK and Australia will have been looking closely at the success of Mark Rutte's flattery offensive this week and may very well decide that the way to save AUKUS may be to just suck it up and metaphorically genuflect.
So maybe they can take a lesson from that. You get him in a good mood, you overflatter him, and he likes it.
Well, I mean, in Rutte's case, you literally call him daddy.
Well, that didn't actually happen, and this is being misreported. He didn't call him daddy. What he said was that, you know, Trump made one of his references to letting countries fight it out. He was saying this about Israel and Iran. And I mean, as bizarre as it is, then Mark Rutte interjected and he said, and sometimes daddy needs to use some strong words.
They've had a big fight, like two kids in a schoolyard. You know, they fight like hell. You can't stop them. Let them fight for about 2-3 minutes. Then it's easier to stop them.
And then daddy has to sometimes use strong language.
Yeah, it's not exactly that way. But anyway, his effusive flattery in many other ways, including the message that he sent to Trump, which was released by Trump, was just really, really gushing.
Those were private text messages that he sent to Trump in the morning before the start of the summit.
Yeah, and then I don't think he expected Trump to release them, because they're kind of embarrassingly flowery. But anyway, he defended them later and said it was all appropriate.
And to be fair, Terry, it worked, right? I mean, if the European country's aim going into the summit was to crack the Trump conundrum and bring the US back into the fold, then this is about as successful as it could have been, right?
In this case, they actually, in my view, can consider this summit a success, because all of their machinations to put Donald Trump in a good mood and have him see NATO in a different light actually worked spectacularly. In his final press conference, he actually seemed to have had almost a religious conversion about the alliance. And he's never spoken like this before. No one's ever seen this Donald Trump in a NATO setting.
I came here because it was something I'm supposed to be doing, but I left here a little bit differently. I said, I watched the heads of these countries get up
And the love and the passion that they showed for their country was unbelievable. I've never seen quite anything like it. They want to protect their country, and they need the United States. And without the United States, it's not going to be the same. And you can ask Mark, or you can ask any of the people that were there. It was really moving to see it.
Well, Terry, I think that we have to know to quit whilst we're ahead. I'll let you get back to filing your final report for DW News.
Thank you, and I appreciate the listeners caring enough to send in questions. It's more interesting than things that come out of my own head. So thanks for doing that, and I hope we do it again soon.
Our email address is insideeurope@dw.com, and you can now also send us a voice memo via speakpipe.com/insideeurope. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Now, you might have noticed that Germany has been missing from our post-NATO summit analysis so far. That was actually because I have something up my sleeve. Our political correspondent Thomas Sparrow has swapped Berlin for Bonn this week and joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Thomas.
So nice to be here, Kate.
Thomas, before Friedrich Merz left for The Hague, he addressed the German parliament and said that the summit would be historic and that Germany was back on the international stage. Is he right? Is Germany back amongst the big players?
And not only did he say that, but in the past he's also stressed that Germany will have the largest conventional army in Europe, or that at least he wants Germany to have the largest conventional army in Europe. And imagine you had gone to sleep 20 years ago and woken up today and you hear this sentence, you would probably think that it's a joke.
Okay, I mean, as you say, an absolutely existential pivot, right? Because in terms of post-war Germany, for very obvious historical reasons, peace, pacifism, non-engagement, you know, it was just written into the DNA of the place. So this is massive. I have a question from a listener, which kind of taps into the sense that everything might potentially be up for discussion. Can I play it to you? It's a voice memo.
This is Alan Axelrod from Massachusetts in the United States. I have a question for Thomas Sparrow. The United States under Donald Trump is an unreliable ally of Europe, with a president who is an apologist for Vladimir Putin. In these circumstances, will Germany consider creating its own nuclear deterrent?
What a question. Basically, what you can say here is that Germany has lived for a very long time now, actually, under the US nuclear shield. But it was clear even before Friedrich Merz became German Chancellor that under Donald Trump, Germany and many other European allies could not necessarily count 100% on the US protecting them. However, at the same time, Merz clearly stressed, and he stressed that actually in March, and I'm quoting here, that Germany cannot and must not have its own nuclear weapons. He said that on March the 9th, and then he added that Germany has expressly renounced the possession of nuclear weapons, and that will remain the case.
I mean, even nuclear energy is taboo in Germany, right? That's how deep this thing goes.
Anything nuclear is extremely controversial here. However, what Merz and his government actually have indicated that they would want to do is discuss nuclear deterrence specifically with France, within the European Union, and with the UK a bit more broadly. These two countries do have nuclear weapons. And as such, Germany would look to have that nuclear deterrence more at a European level as part of this European independence.
Okay, so great question, Axel. Basically, I'm hearing, Thomas, that the answer is that yes, there is concern in Germany. Backup options are being sought, but it will not be a domestic nuclear deterrent. It will be looking to sort of slip under France's protective net if this happens.
I see it as a shift that is happening as part of many other aspects. I mean, whether you see Germany as the largest conventional army in Europe, again, a taboo only until a few years ago, whether you look at 5% of GDP towards NATO, which again would have been a taboo several years ago. These are all shifts, very, very, very powerful, very strong shifts that are happening. that are also creating a big debate here in the country, because not everyone is happy with this. Even in the coalition, there are members specifically from the Social Democrats that see this trend with concern, not to mention other political parties in the opposition.
Whilst we're on controversy, I have to ask about this, Thomas, because it's been absolutely huge in Germany. Last week, Friedrich Merz gave a TV interview in which he described Israel as doing the West's dirty work. That's a quote for it, when it attacked Iran. Now, he's actually the subject of a legal complaint which accuses him of breaking an article in the Constitution which protects the peaceful cohabitation of peoples. That's the level to which this is controversial. What's going on?
There are indeed a lot of people here in Germany that were shocked by this dirty work statement, by this very strong statement by the Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, and that have criticised him very openly and very strongly for the implications of that statement, for the political implications of that statement, and for what it means also for the Chancellor, for the government, and for Germany as well. I can imagine that this is one of those sentences that will mark Friedrich Merz as a Chancellor. In other words, in 4 or 5 or 6 or 10 years, when we look back, I can imagine that this will be one of those sentences that will be part of his political legacy.
So Friedrich Merz basically has pegged his legacy to foreign policy. Israel is inevitably going to be a massive part of that. Germany continues to be the largest supplier of arms to Israel after the US. This is taking place at a time when, I mean, I was reading that, you know, in the past couple of weeks, some 500 people are reported to have been killed by Israeli army fire whilst trying to access humanitarian relief, which means food, right? These are people queuing for food. Merz wants to be a foreign policy big player, right? This is where he sees his legacy. This is where he's going to make his mark. But Gaza and what happens in Gaza, it's always going to be a part of that, right?
I do think it will be a part of it, specifically because of Germany's support of Israel, not only militarily, but also politically. I also think it could be a part of it because Friedrich Merz has already started to position himself as this foreign policy chancellor. And obviously one of the main topics now is Gaza. I do believe that if Friedrich Merz continues to position himself as this foreign policy chancellor, his legacy will undoubtedly be marked by what he says and what he does in those regards, whether it is Gaza, whether it is now the topic with Iran, whether it is his positions towards the United States, whether it is his role in the European Union. And he does want Germany, and I come back to your first question, to be this big player in Europe. But if you also see how things have developed in recent days, I don't have the impression that Germany was a protagonist, or at least that Germany was asked very profoundly by the United States before Donald Trump decided to carry out his military operation against Iranian nuclear sites. So I don't have the impression that Germany is yet that big foreign policy player that Merz would want it to be. That's at least his intention, and he still has some time to prove it, or he still has some time to show that he maybe only had the words, but not necessarily the action to match it.
Well, we're speaking around the 50-day mark in terms of Friedrich Merz's chancellery, so maybe we'll have you back in 50 days' time, Thomas, and do the 100 days roundup.
Every 50 days I'll be here, Kate.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Thomas.
My pleasure.
DW political correspondent Thomas Sparrow there. It's all change in the second half of the show. If I say the words Bezos and wedding, then you can probably guess where we're headed. If you're listening via a partner station, which leaves us at this point, then do not worry. You will find it all on our podcast feed. That's here on Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock. Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. As promised, we have the Inside Europe take on the Bezos nuptials in Vienna coming up for you shortly, as well as a whole load of protest in Slovakia surrounding the much-hyped, soon-to-be appearance there of the artist formerly known as Kanye West. Before looking at the controversies surrounding those respective European visits, however, I wanted to begin with a piece about people who are unquestionably exactly where they were always meant to be, the indigenous Sami people who live in northern Norway, Finland and Sweden. Earlier this week, there was in Norway another clash between Sami reindeer herders and a mining company. This is the latest such incident to act as a reminder of the ongoing threats to traditional Sami life and culture. Lars Bevanger sent us this report from Tromsø in Norway.
The native Sami populations of northern Norway, Sweden, Finland and Russia have made a living off the land for millennia. Reindeer herding is still central to their culture and survival. Since the 1800s, however, they've been in conflict with the nation states over natural resources and access to land. Today, the Sami are facing increasingly complex challenges to their way of life. Temperatures are rising nearly four times faster in the Arctic, and environmental programs like wind farms aimed at mitigating this fact also impacts the Sami's way of life.
I'm Aili Geskidalu. I'm an indigenous advisor for Amnesty Norway and the former president of the Sami Parliament in Norway. The Nordic states are allowing a kind of bit-by-bit eating of Sami lands. And that has a great impact, a scary impact on the foundation of the Sami culture. And because we live cross-border, nobody seems to take the full responsibility of protecting the areas we need for our livelihoods and for our survival.
For the past 40 years or so, Samis have had their own parliaments in Norway, Sweden and Finland, but only the Norwegian one gives them some decision-making powers over land rights. Samis are also represented on the Arctic Council, the intergovernmental forum for cooperation between Arctic states. Yet they have no voting rights there, and their role is advisory.
So where have things gone wrong? Because clearly in Norway there's been several court cases between the Sami population and the Norwegian state. Why is it impossible to sit down and talk about it?
Well, talking about it is a good thing, but it's not enough. We need the states to implement indigenous people's rights to free, prior, informed consent when it comes to land use. With climate change and the consequences of climate change, the double effect is quite disturbing and destroying the natural foundation for our culture.
Earlier this week, Sami demonstrators alongside Norwegian environmentalists were forcefully removed by police from the site of a new copper mine in the high Arctic north of Norway. Direct action like this is nothing new. Back in 1979, a semi-permanent Sami camp was set up outside the Norwegian parliament in Oslo in protest against a proposed hydroelectric dam in Sami areas. The project went ahead. In May this year, the Norwegian Sami parliament met the Norwegian state in court over Norway's latest energy project, which will see a dramatic increase in wind farms and pylons in Arctic Norway.
The strategy of building wind turbines in reindeer herding areas, it's a big threat against our culture, and we struggle with having our voices heard.
Sandra Maria West is a political advisor for the governing council of the Sami parliament in Norway. She argues they were left with no option but to take the state to court over the energy project.
That is a decision that the Norwegian government made without making impact assessments and without consulting the Sami parliament. They announced their strategy and decision, and 2 days later we got a reply to the letter that we sent 7 months prior, and they said, no, this is not a matter of consultation. In our opinion, this is grave. It will have enormous consequences on Sami culture, and that is why we have taken the Norwegian government to court on this matter.
What would you like to see done so that you have more representation? It sounds like you're not quite satisfied with the status quo.
No, you're right. I'm not satisfied. If we're going to have real consultations, then actually both parties need to want to find a solution. It's not a real consultation if we are meeting the government and they have already made up their mind.
The Arctic North is also an important front line with Putin's Russia. And now that Sweden and Finland are NATO members alongside Norway, military activity is increasing in Sami areas. Again, with not enough consultation, points out Laura Jonkaukio, a professor of Northern politics and government at the University of Lapland in Finland.
As in the context of the Green Transition, we are in a situation in which the Sami have to sacrifice disproportionately things that are important for their security in service of national security. For example, the Finnish state, when it signed the Defence Cooperation Agreement with the United States, there was an area in the Sami homeland region in Finland included in this agreement, but the Sami were never consulted.
The Norwegian government says both the constitution and several legal provisions secure sufficient legal frameworks and consultation mechanisms to safeguard Sami rights when it comes to energy development and military activities in northern Norway. The next test of this is just around the corner when the court will rule in the case the Sami parliament brought against the Norwegian state last month. Lars Bevanger, DW, Tromsø.
And the traditional Sami joik singing that you heard at the start of Lars's report there was Finnish artist Heli Aikio's entry into this year's Sami Grand Prix, which is the Sami answer to Eurovision, and which was aired on 12th of April this year. Now, it's time. This was Venice, wrote Thomas Mann in 1912. The flattering and suspect beauty. This city, half fairy tale, half tourist trap, in whose insalubrious air the arts once rankly and voluptuously blossomed, where composers have been inspired to lulling tones of somniferous eroticism. This week, however, Venice is the site of the Bezos nuptials, as Jeff, 61, Amazon founder and one of the world's richest men, marries Lauren, 55, journalist, entrepreneur and astronaut. Venetians themselves, however, don't seem to be entirely on board with the party, as our reporter, Angelo van Schaik, has been finding out.
Venice is its usual self, loaded with tourists and beautifully laid out in the summer sun. But something is boiling underneath the surface. As in almost every calle, posters with the words "No space for Bezos" have appeared. Many Venetians don't want Jeff Bezos taking over their city.
Non siamo contro il matrimonio in sé, ma siamo contro l'utilizzo che si fa di Venezia.
Bezos, we are not against the marriage itself, says Josué David, a member of the protest movement No Space for Bezos. But we are against the way Venice is being treated. A very wealthy man comes here and uses Venice like his personal amusement park, like some kind of king. He arrives in the lagoon with 9 yachts, an ecosystem that is already under threat, and he blocks half the city. We are not protesting so much against him personally, but rather against the way he acts, and against the city administration that makes all of this possible. The Bezos wedding is a multi-day affair, with guests attending a variety of parties spread out around the city in the run-up to the actual tying of the knot. At the time of recording, the rumor is that the large closing celebration on Saturday has had to move location due to security fears raised by the authorities. Additionally, the US billionaire's large yacht Kourou is no longer expected to come to the city as originally planned. even the smaller run-up events have been shrouded in mystery. As I found out a few days ago when I popped by the Scuola della Misericordia in the city centre.
Bezos non glielo so dire. Adesso abbiamo, cos'è, domani c'è un matrimonio.
Giovanni, white linen shirt with rolled up sleeves and sunglasses, supervises the preparations for an event, but not a Bezos one, he says. He did read in the newspapers that the billionaire is due to use their location later in the week. But, he says, he wouldn't know anything about that. Whatever Giovanni may or may not have known as we spoke, a few days later the Italian authorities asked for a part of the festivities to be moved from the Scuola della Misericordia to the Arsenale, as that venue is easier to secure. The threat level, they made clear, had been raised by the US attack on Iran. Jeff Bezos, let's not forget, is not just one of the world's richest men, he's also a major Pentagon contractor through his two enterprises. Blue Origin recently awarded a contract for 7 rocket missions worth a combined total of $2.3 billion and Amazon Web Services, which provides cloud services to the Department of Defense. Visit Amman Hotel. Security warnings and angry locals are unlikely to deter Bezos' 200-plus guests. Many of them expected to be A-list celebrities like Ivanka Trump, Oprah Winfrey and Leonardo DiCaprio. The luxurious 5-star hotels along the Canal Grande are all booked out. Only no one seems to know who is staying there.
Se ho capito bene, durante il matrimonio di Jeff Bezos, alcuni dei ospiti saranno qua, giusto?
Noi non abbiamo nessuna informazione riguardo.
No?
No.
This friendly but very firm hostess says she doesn't have any information about Bezos' guests sleeping in their hotel. Probably she isn't allowed to reveal anything about that. From the silent discretion of hotel staff to the loud protests of the streets, the Bezos nuptials are a spectacle of contrasts. The main contrast, however, is the one that pits the international super-rich against the ordinary residents in Venice. In protesters' minds, it's clear which side the mayor, Luigi Brugnaro, has come down on.
Beneficiari di questo matrimonio sarà sicuramente il sindaco in primis perché...
One of the people that benefit from the wedding is the mayor himself, says protester Josué David. One of the venues that host one of the parties is owned by him. Mayor Brugnaro, however, is very angry with the protesters.
Sappiate che a Venezia siamo in mano a una deriva assurda.
He calls them a disgrace for the city. According to him, the wedding is an opportunity for Venice, and he hopes Jeff Bezos will find the time to shake his hand. Venice mayor and the protesters disagree on everything, but they have one thing in common. They all hope this wedding will be over soon. Angelo van Schaik, DW, Venice, Italy.
We have another piece about an unwelcome but fabulously rich visitor from the US next, but there, and I really want to be clear about this, the similarities end. And the fact that I'm being very careful to make that point probably tells you something about the horror with which European countries view the opinions expressed by the subject of our next report. I am, of course, talking about Ye, the artist formerly known as Kanye West. Ye is due to appear at Bratislava's Rubicon Festival on July 20th. But concerned Slovaks have launched an online petition against the show on the grounds that Ye, who's described himself as a Nazi in the past, is normalising a murderous ideology that has no place in Europe. Rob Cameron reports from Prague.
Rubicon Festival, who were leaked by Rolling Loud Europe to have Ye headlining, have just posted this on their Instagram story.
Great excitement on Instagram as a true global megastar is announced as the headliner for this year's Rubicon Rap Festival, an event held in a field just across the road from Bratislava's Volkswagen factory. Organisers say this will be Ye's sole appearance in Europe in 2025, Tickets are now on sale for an artist that organisers describe as hip-hop visionary, cultural icon and controversial genius, who's now headlining the three-day event. In fact, at time of writing, it appears to be Ye's only confirmed appearance anywhere in the world this year. That may be due to the artist's recent track, Heil Hitler, released on May the 8th, when the rest of the world was marking VE Day. The track was quickly removed by platforms like Apple, Spotify, and YouTube, but remains on X. The song was the latest in a series of posts and comments that marked the rapper's ongoing idealization of Hitler and the Nazis. That began in 2022 with an appearance on the video podcast by the notorious conspiracy theorist Alex Jones.
Well, I see good things about Hitler also. The Jew, I love everyone. I'm done with the classifications. Every human being has something of value that they brought to the table, especially Hitler.
A few weeks ago, Ye made what detractors said was a ludicrously transparent attempt at a mea culpa, posting "I am done with anti-Semitism" on X, claiming that a FaceTime call with his children had motivated him to seek an apology and that he was ready to save the world again. That hasn't satisfied opponents in Slovakia. Activists have launched an online petition against his appearance at the festival. The campaign is headed by Lucia Štaslerová, who's also a Bratislava City Council member.
He adore Adolf Hitler and fascism like quite fine ideology and so on and so on. So this is not only his profile is not only what organizers are writing. He has other face. So that's why we protest against it. And exactly in these times where this nationalist movement around the world and in Slovakia as well, that is danger for society to strengthen this movement.
Lucia's colleague, the mayor of Bratislava, Matoš Valo, has issued a statement saying that Ye's openly anti-Semitic and pro-Hitler views stand in contradiction to both his own values and the values of his city, a city that lost thousands of Jews to the Holocaust when Slovakia was a vassal state of Nazi Germany. The capital said the mayor would not be providing any logistical support to the event. However, the field itself is not city property, so he can't ban it. Instead, the plot of land belongs to a northern district of Bratislava called Záhorská Bystrica, but the mayor there can't ban it either unless there are legitimate grounds to do so, i.e. inadequate hygiene facilities, not enough parking, safety concerns, and so on. It's unclear whether they have enough legally to go on. Organisers meanwhile swear blind. The rapper will be in the Slovak capital, but not everyone is convinced Ye will actually turn up in Bratislava. Some even suggest the whole thing is a massive publicity stunt. If he does fail to materialise, Rubicon 2025 will find themselves with a large field of angry rap fans who've just been duped. For DW, this is Rob Cameron. In Prague.
That's a hot take that you heard first on Inside Europe. We'll just have to wait and see whether Rob Cameron's suspicions are confirmed. We will no doubt be following that here on Inside Europe. One event which we can safely predict will be taking place as billed is the 2025 UEFA Women's Championships. They run from July 2nd to July 27th. But in which European country? Head on over to Spotify if you know the answer or if you just want to take a guess. And also, at this point, a big shout out to the best female footballer in my personal acquaintance, 11-year-old Lovis Severens of Düsseldorf. You'll find our show on all the other usual platforms too, of course. Just search for Inside Europe. Regular listeners to the show may be aware that we have a content sharing agreement with The World podcast from PRX and GBH. Last week, The World featured a story on an event in Vienna, billed by its organisers as the first ever Jewish anti-Zionist conference. From June 13th to 15th, around 500 people, activists, academics, and the curious, came from around the world to discuss and reject Zionism, a political ideology that calls for the establishment of a Jewish nation-state. And, thanks to our partners at The World, I can now share Rebecca Collard's report with you.
If you aren't looking for it, you'd probably miss it. A plaque on the right side of a small stone stairway in Vienna's first district, dedicated to Theodor Herzl, Vienna resident and the man largely considered the founder of modern Zionism in the late 19th century. A tour guide explains to a group of seemingly disinterested tourists Herzl's life and ideas.
At the beginning of his life in Vienna, he had a very different opinion regarding Jewish state being necessary or not. Beginning, it said Jewish people don't need their own state. They should integrate and live in the societies where they are integrated in the societies they're living in.
Herzl once lived on the street at the bottom of these steps. The building where he lived is now covered in scaffolding, offering soon-coming luxury apartments. From there, you can see across the Danube to Leopoldstadt, once a densely populated Jewish neighborhood, the result of centuries of anti-Semitic persecution and expulsion of Jews from the center of Vienna. The neighborhood was also where Herzl's family first settled when they arrived from Budapest in 1878.
And he came to the conclusion, even though many Jewish people try their best fit into society, they won't ever be accepted 100%. So the only way for Jewish people to live in peace is on their own territory, with their own Jewish state.
That conclusion, that Jews would only be truly safe in their own state, was articulated in his 1896 book, Der Judenstaat.
We each carry different stories, but actually I think that the one thing that we all...
What organizers call the city's first Jewish anti-Zionist Congress attracted Israelis, Jews, allies, activists, and academics from as far away as Vancouver. Inside the hall, large banners hang from the walls in English and German. Stop Zionism, Judaism is not Zionism, and never again for everyone. Dalia Sadek is one of the organizers. Her own family fled to Palestine before the creation of Israel and returned to Austria after the Holocaust.
The people in Austria, I think, should take away and that anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitic, and that's very important.
The organizers kept the exact location of the Congress secret until just days before the event. Previous Palestinian solidarity events in Vienna have received pushback from pro-Israeli groups and the official Jewish community. Reflective of a growing divide here and among Jewish communities globally over support for Israel. Not just over the occupation of Palestinians or the war in Gaza, but over the very idea of a Jewish state.
I think Zionism delivered something that a lot of people bought into. It was, you know, how can I be Jewish when I'm not religious? So it's kind of this thing that Zionism used to gather Jews around the world and to collect them into this national ideology.
The Zionist movement is in origin Christian Protestant.
Yakov Rapkin is a professor of history at the University of Montreal and spoke to the conference via video link. Later, he explained that Jewish opposition to Zionism is as old as the idea of Zionism itself. Herzl held his first Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland, in 1897. Rapkin says he faced three types of Jewish opposition.
One, religious, the idea that you can gather Jews in the Holy Land before the arrival of Messiah. Two, the Jews who were integrating into European societies and they didn't want to hear that they don't belong there. And finally, there were people who considered Zionism to be a distraction from class struggle. And these, of course, are the socialists.
The Holocaust eroded much of that opposition among many of the European Jews who survived. Rapkin says there has been an effort by Israel to tie Jewishness to Zionism. But increasingly younger Jews are saying they don't want anything to do with the Jewish state.
This, of course, has worked for many people. But as you know, younger Jews today, particularly in the United States, have second thoughts and have distanced themselves from Israel. And the recent events in Gaza, and I would dare say even in Iran, certainly doesn't endear Zionism to these people.
The expected opposition from the official Jewish community didn't materialize, but a Volkswagen hatchback with German plates, flying Israeli flags, and the flags of Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party does. One of the two occupants of the car says she's Jewish. She would only give her first name, Sophia.
It seems to me what these people are saying is they want to decouple Jewishness from nationalism, of Zionism. And how does that make you feel?
I feel it ultra anti-Semitic. For me, anti-Zionism is equal to anti-Semitism.
Do you feel that way even when it's being advocated for by Jews that are anti-Zionist? Do you still feel like they're anti-Semitic?
Well, first of all, it's a very, very tiny minority. As we have seen out of historical experience, anti-Zionism is always connected with killing Jews.
Participants at the conference reject that and say the Jewish state hasn't kept Jews safe and has cost the lives and displacement of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. And in the very city where Herzl made his case for the Jewish state, they are now coming together to reject it. For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard in Vienna.
We've nearly reached the end of the show, but before I go, I have some news to share with you, good and bad. The good first. We're delighted to announce that the Ukrainian Radio Free Europe journalist Ladislav Yesipenko has been released, having spent over 4 years imprisoned in occupied Crimea. The bad news is that last Friday, Radio Free Europe journalist Farid Merilitzada, whose case we have been following on the programme, was convicted and sentenced to 9 years in prison by a Baku court. Six other journalists were also given lengthy prison sentences at the same time. I've asked my colleague Nick Martin to read an extract of Farid's final statement to the court.
Unfortunately, journalism in our country today is almost equated with terrorism. The average age of the seven accused persons participating in this process is 34. This year also marks the 34th anniversary of the restoration of Azerbaijan's state independence. The coincidence of these numbers perfectly reflects the state of press freedom in Azerbaijan over those past 34 years. I would like to end my thoughts with the words of Joseph, the hero of Franz Kafka's The Trial. Understand, I am completely uninterested in how the trial ends, and I will simply laugh at the verdict. If I were to be born again, I would still choose to be on the side of good, not evil.
I'll be posting links with more information about Farid Merilitzada's case and the ongoing clampdown on media freedom in Azerbaijan in our show notes. That is it for today. This programme was produced by me, Kate Laycock, with editorial support from Sarah Hoffman and Sanya Blagojevich. Our sound engineer was Ziad Abu Sleiman. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.